church to forge a new identity for the Communist Party, creating a new kind of believer. Once his winter had passed, he reemerged, his enemies succumbing to their own weaknesses, himself strengthened by a period of retreat. War is deceptive. You may think that you are strong and that you are making advances against an enemy, but time may show that you are actually marching into great danger. You can never really know, since our immersion in the present deprives us of true perspective. The best you can do is to rid yourself of lazy, conventional patterns of thinking. Advancing is not always good. Retreating is not always weak. In fact, in moments of danger or trouble, refusing to fight is often the best strategy. By disengaging from the enemy, you lose nothing that is valuable in the long run and gain time to turn inward, rethink your ideas, separate the true believers from the hangers-on. Time becomes your ally. By doing nothing outwardly, you gain inner strength, which will translate into tremendous power later when it is time to act. By Napoleon Bonaparte. Space I can recover. Time, never. Keys to Warfare. The problem we all face in strategy and in life is that each of us is unique and has a unique personality. Our circumstances are also unique. No situation ever really repeats itself. But most often we are barely aware of what makes us different. In other words, of who we really are. Our ideas come from books, teachers, all kinds of unseen influences. We respond to events routinely and mechanically, instead of trying to understand their differences. In our dealings with other people, too, we are easily infected by their tempo and mood. All this creates a kind of fog. We fail to see events for what they are. We do not know ourselves. Your task as a strategist is simple. To see the differences between yourself and other people. To understand yourself, your side, and the enemy as well as you can. To get more perspective on events. To know things for what they are. In the hubbub of daily life, this is not easy. In fact, the power to do it can come only from knowing when and how to retreat. If you are always advancing, always attacking, always responding to people emotionally, you have no time to gain perspective. Your strategies will be weak and mechanical, based on things that happened in the past or to someone else. Like a monkey, you will imitate instead of create. Retreating is something you must do every now and then to find yourself and detach yourself from infecting influences. And the best time to do this is in moments of difficulty and danger. Symbolically, the retreat is religious or mythological. It was only by escaping into the desert that Moses and the Jews were able to solidify their identity and reemerge as a social and political force. Jesus spent his 40 days in the wilderness, and Muhammad too fled Mecca at a time of great peril for a period of retreat. He and just a handful of his most devoted supporters used this period to deepen their bonds, to understand who they were and what they stood for, to let time work its good. Then this little band of believers reemerged to conquer Mecca and the Arabian Peninsula, and later, after Muhammad's death, to defeat the Byzantines and the Persian Empire, spreading Islam over vast territories. Around the world, every mythology has a hero who retreats, even to Hades itself in the case of Odysseus, to find himself. If Moses had stayed and fought in Egypt, the Jews would be a footnote in history. If Muhammad had taken on his enemies in Mecca, he would have been crushed and forgotten. When you fight someone more powerful than you are, you lose more than your possessions and position. You lose your ability to think straight, to keep yourself separate and distinct. You become infected with the emotions and violence of the aggressor in ways you cannot imagine. Better to flee and use the time your flight buys to turn inward. Let the enemy take land and advance. You will recover and turn the tables when the time comes. The decision to retreat shows not weakness, but strength. It is the height of strategic wisdom. The essence of retreat is the refusal to engage the enemy in any way, whether psychologically or physically. You may do this defensively to protect yourself, but it can also be a positive strategy. By refusing to fight aggressive enemies, you can effectively infuriate and unbalance them. During World War I, England and Germany fought a side war in East Africa, where each of them had a colony. In 1915, the English commander, Lieutenant General Jan Smuts, moved against the much smaller German army in German East Africa, led by Colonel Paul von Lettow-Vorbeck. Smuts was hoping for a quick win. As soon as he had finished off the Germans, his troops could move to more important theaters of war. But von Lettow-Vorbeck refused to engage him and retreated south. Smuts marched in pursuit. Time and again, Smuts thought he had von Lettow-Vorbeck cornered, only to find that the German officer had moved on just hours earlier. As if drawn by a magnet, Smuts followed von Lettow-Vorbeck across rivers, mountains, and forests. Their supply lines extended over hundreds of miles. His soldiers were now vulnerable to small, harassing actions from the Germans, which destroyed their morale. Bogged down in pestilential jungles, as time went by, Smuts's army was decimated by hunger and disease, all without ever fighting a real battle. By the end of the war, von Lettow-Vorbeck had managed to lead his enemy on a 4-year cat-and-mouse chase that had completely tied up valuable English forces and yielded them nothing in return. Smuts was a persistent, thorough, aggressive leader who liked to defeat his opponents through maneuver in the field. Von Lettow-Vorbeck played on this taste. He refused to engage Smuts in frontal battle, but stayed enticingly close, just beyond reach, holding out the possibility of engagement so as to keep the Englishman pushing forward into the wilderness. Infuriated to no end, Smuts continued the chase. Von Lettow-Vorbeck used Africa's vast spaces and inhospitable climate to destroy the English. Most people respond to aggression by, in some way, getting involved with it. It is almost impossible to hold back. By disengaging completely and retreating, you show great power and restraint. Your enemies are desperate for you to react. Retreat infuriates and provokes them into further attack, so keep retreating, exchanging space for time. Stay calm and balanced. Let them take the land they want. Like the Germans, lure them into a void of non-action. They will start to overextend themselves and make mistakes. Time is on your side, for you are not wasting any of it in useless battles. War is notoriously full of surprises, of unforeseen events that can slow down and ruin even the best-laid plan. Karl von Clausewitz called this friction. War is a constant illustration of Murphy's Law. If anything can go wrong, it will. But when you retreat, when you exchange space for time, you are making Murphy's Law work for you. So it was with von Lettow-Vorbeck. He set up Smuts as the victim of Murphy's Law, giving him enough time to make the worst come to pass. During the Seven Years' War, 1756 to 63, Frederick the Great of Prussia was faced with Austrian, French, and Russian armies on every side, all determined to carve him up. A strategist who usually favored aggressive attack, Frederick this time went on the defensive, crafting his maneuvers to buy himself time and slip the net his enemies were trying to catch him in. Year after year he managed to avoid disaster, though barely. Then suddenly, Tsarina Elizabeth of Russia died. She had hated Frederick bitterly, but her nephew and successor to the throne, Tsar Peter III, was a perverse young boy who had not liked his aunt and greatly admired Frederick the Great. He not only pulled Russia out of the war, he allied himself with the Prussians. The Seven Years' War was over. The miracle Frederick needed had come to pass. Had he surrendered at his worst point, or tried to fight his way out, he would have lost everything. Instead, he maneuvered to create time for Murphy's Law to do its work on his enemies. War is a physical affair which takes place somewhere specific. Generals depend on maps and plan strategies to be realized in particular locations. But time is just as important as space in strategic thought, and knowing how to use time will make you a superior strategist, giving an added dimension to your attacks and defense. To do this, you must stop thinking of time as an abstraction In reality, beginning the minute you were born, time is all you have. It is your only true commodity. People can take away your possessions, but short of murder, not even the most powerful aggressors can take time away from you unless you let them. Even in prison, your time is your own if you use it for your own purposes. To waste your time in battles not of your choosing is more than just a mistake. It is stupidity of the highest order. Time lost can never be regained. Reversal. When enemies attack you in overwhelming force, instead of retreating, you may sometimes decide to engage them directly. You are inviting martyrdom, perhaps even hoping for it. But martyrdom, too, is a strategy, and one of ancient standing. Martyrdom makes you a symbol, a rallying point for the future. The strategy will succeed if you are important enough, if your defeat has symbolic meaning, but the circumstances must work to highlight the rightness of your cause and the ugliness of the enemy's. Your sacrifice must also be unique. Too many martyrs, spread over too much time, will spoil the effect. In cases of extreme weakness, when facing an impossibly large enemy, martyrdom can be used to show that your side's fighting spirit has not been extinguished, a useful way to keep up morale. But, in general, martyrdom is a dangerous weapon and can backfire, for you may no longer be there to see it through, and its effects are too strong to be controlled. It can also take centuries to work. Even when it may prove symbolically successful, a good strategist avoids it. Retreat is always the better strategy. Retreat must never be an end in itself. At some point, you have to turn around and fight. If you don't, retreat is more accurately called surrender. The enemy wins. Combat is, in the long run, unavoidable. Retreat can only be temporary. Here are further reflections on the strategy of non-engagement. From the I Ching. 6 in the fourth place means the army retreats, no blame. In face of a superior enemy, with whom it would be hopeless to engage in battle, an orderly retreat is the only correct procedure, because it will save the army from defeat and disintegration. It is by no means a sign of courage or strength to insist upon engaging in a hopeless struggle regardless of circumstances. From the Huainanzi, China, 2nd century B.C. Opportunities are changing ceaselessly. Those who get there too early have gone too far, while those who get there too late cannot catch up. As the sun and moon go through their courses, time does not go along with people. Therefore, sages do not value huge jewels as much as they value a little time. Time is hard to find and easy to lose. Part 4. Offensive Warfare. The greatest dangers in war and in life come from the unexpected. People do not respond the way you had thought they would. Events mess up your plans and produce confusion. Circumstances are overwhelming. In strategy, this discrepancy between what you want to happen and what does happen is called friction. The idea behind conventional offensive warfare is simple. By attacking the other side first, hitting its points of vulnerability, and seizing the initiative and never letting it go, you create your own circumstances. Before any friction can creep in and undermine your plans, you move to the offensive, and your relentless maneuvers force so much friction on the enemy that he collapses. This is the form of warfare practiced by the most successful captains in history, and the secret to their success is a perfect blend of strategic cleverness and audacity. The strategic element comes in the planning, setting an overall goal, crafting ways to reach it, and thinking the whole plan through in intense detail. This means thinking in terms of a campaign, not individual battles. It also means knowing the strengths and weaknesses of the other side, so that you can calibrate your strikes to its vulnerabilities. The more detailed your planning, the more confident you will feel as you go into battle, and the easier it will be to stay on course once the inevitable problems arise. In the attack itself, though, You must strike with such spirit and audacity that you put your enemies on their heels, giving irresistible momentum to your offensive. The following 11 chapters will initiate you into this supreme form of warfare. They will help you to put your desires and goals into a larger framework known as grand strategy. They will show you how to look at your enemies and uncover their secrets. They will describe how a solid base of planning will give you fluid options for attack, and how specific maneuvers, the flanking maneuver, the envelopment, and styles of attack, hitting centers of gravity, forcing the enemy into positions of great weakness, that work brilliantly in war, can be applied in life. Finally, they will show you how to finish off your campaign. Without a vigorous conclusion that meets your overall goals, everything you have done will be worthless. Mastering the various components of offensive warfare will give all of your attacks in life much greater force. Chapter 12. Lose battles, but win the war. Grand strategy. Everyone around you is a strategist angling for power, all trying to promote their own interests, often at your expense. Your daily battles with them make you lose sight of the only thing that really matters. Victory in the end. The achievement of greater goals. Lasting power. Grand strategy is the art of looking beyond the battle and calculating ahead. It requires that you focus on your ultimate goal and plot to reach it. In grand strategy, you consider the political ramifications and long-term consequences of what you do. Instead of reacting emotionally to people, you take control and make your actions more dimensional, subtle, and effective. Let others get caught up in the twists and turns of the battle, relishing their little victories. Grand strategy will bring you the ultimate reward, the last laugh. The Great Campaign. Growing up at the Macedonian court, Alexander, 356 to 322 BC, was considered a rather strange young man. He enjoyed the usual boyish pursuits, such as horses and warfare. Having fought alongside his father, King Philip II, in several battles, he had proved his bravery. But he also loved philosophy and literature. His tutor was the great thinker Aristotle, under whose influence he loved to argue about politics and science, looking at the world as dispassionately as possible. Then there was his mother, Olympias. A mystical, superstitious woman, she had had visions at Alexander's birth that he would one day rule the known world. She told him about them and filled him with stories of Achilles, from whom her family claimed descent. Alexander adored his mother, while hating his father, and took her prophecies most seriously. From early on in life, he carried himself as if he were more than the son of a king. Alexander was raised to be Philip's successor, and the state he was to inherit had grown considerably during his father's reign. Over the years, the king had managed to build up the Macedonian army into the supreme force in all Greece. He had defeated Thebes and Athens, and had united all the Greek city-states, except Sparta, into a Hellenic League under his leadership. He was a crafty, intimidating ruler. Then, in 336 BC, a disgruntled nobleman assassinated him. Suddenly seeing Macedonia as vulnerable, Athens declared its independence from the League. The other city-states followed suit. Tribes from the north now threatened to invade. Almost overnight, Philip's small empire was unraveling. When Alexander came to the throne, he was only 20, and many considered him unready. It was a bad time for learning on the job. The Macedonian generals and political leaders would have to take him under their wing. They advised him to go slowly, to consolidate his position in both the army and Macedonia, and then gradually reform the League through force and guile. That was what Philip would have done. But Alexander would not listen. He had another plan, or so it seemed. Without giving his enemies in and beyond Macedonia time to organize against him, he led the army south and reconquered Thebes in a series of lightning maneuvers. Next, he marched on the Athenians, who, fearing his retribution, begged forgiveness and pleaded to be readmitted to the League. Alexander granted their wish. The eccentric young prince had shown himself to be a bold and unpredictable king, attacking when he was not meant to, yet showing Athens unexpected mercy. He was hard to read, but his first maneuvers as king had won him many admirers. His next move, however, was still stranger and more audacious. Instead of working to consolidate his gains and strengthen the fragile League, he proposed to launch a crusade against the Persian Empire, the Greeks' great enemy. Some 150 years earlier, the Persians had tried to invade Greece. They had almost succeeded, and it remained their dream to try it again and get it right. With Persia a constant threat, the Greeks could never rest easy, and their maritime trade was cramped by the power of the Persian navy. In 334 BC, Alexander led a united army of 35,000 Greeks across the Dardanelles Straits and into Asia Minor, the westernmost part of the Persian Empire. In their first encounter with the enemy, at the Battle of the Granicus, the Greeks routed the Persians. Alexander's generals could only admire his boldness. He seemed poised to conquer Persia, fulfilling his mother's prophecy in record time. He succeeded through speed and by seizing the initiative. Now, soldiers and generals alike expected him to head straight east into Persia to finish off the enemy army, which seemed surprisingly weak. Once again, Alexander confounded expectations, suddenly deciding to do what he had never done before, take his time. That would have seemed wise when he first came to power, but now it seemed likely to give the Persians the one thing they needed, time to recover and replenish. Yet Alexander led his army not east, but south, down the coast of Asia Minor, freeing local towns from Persian rule. Next, he zigzagged east and then south again, through Phoenicia and into Egypt, quickly defeating the weak Persian garrison there. The Egyptians hated their Persian rulers and welcomed Alexander as their liberator. Now Alexander could use Egypt's vast stores of grain to feed the Greek army and help keep the Greek economy stable while depriving Persia of valuable resources. As the Greeks advanced farther from home, the Persian navy, which could land an army almost anywhere in the Mediterranean to attack them from the rear or flank, was a worrying threat. Before Alexander set out on his expedition, many had advised him to build up the Greek navy and take the battle to the Persians by sea as well as land. Alexander had ignored them. Instead, as he passed through Asia Minor and then along the coast of Phoenicia, he simply captured Persia's principal ports, rendering their navy useless. These small victories, then, had a greater strategic purpose. Even so, they would have meant little had the Greeks been unable to defeat the Persians in battle, and Alexander seemed to be making that victory more difficult. The Persian king Darius was concentrating his forces east of the Tigris River. He had numbers and his choice of location and could wait in ease for Alexander to cross the river. Had Alexander lost his taste for battle? Had Persian and Egyptian culture softened him? It seemed so. He had begun to wear Persian clothes and to adopt Persian customs. He was even seen worshipping Persian gods. As the Persian army retreated east of the Tigris, large areas of the Persian Empire had come under Greek control. Now Alexander spent much of his time not on warfare, but on politics, trying to see how best to govern these regions. He decided to build on the Persian system already in place, keeping the same titles for jobs in the governmental bureaucracy, collecting the same tribute that Darius had done. He changed only the harsh, unpopular aspects of Persian rule. Word quickly spread of his generosity and gentleness toward his new subjects. Town after town surrendered to the Greeks without a fight, only too glad to be part of Alexander's growing empire, which transcended Greece and Persia. He was the unifying factor, the benevolent, overseeing god. Finally, in 331 BC, Alexander marched on the main Persian force at Arbela. What his generals had not understood was that, deprived of the use of its navy, its rich lands in Egypt, and the support and tribute of almost all of its subjects, the Persian Empire had already crumbled. Alexander's victory at Arbela merely confirmed militarily what he had already achieved months earlier. He was now the ruler of the once mighty Persian Empire. Fulfilling his mother's prophecy, he controlled almost all of the known world. Interpretation. Alexander the Great's maneuvers bewildered his staff. They seemed to have no logic, no consistency. Only later could the Greeks look back and really see his magnificent achievement. The reason they could not understand him was that Alexander had invented a whole new way of thinking and acting in the world, the art of grand strategy. In grand strategy, you look beyond the moment, beyond your immediate battles and concerns. You concentrate instead on what you want to achieve down the line. Controlling the temptation to react to events as they happen, you determine each of your actions according to your ultimate goals. You think in terms not of individual battles, but of a campaign. Alexander owed his novel style of strategizing to his mother and to Aristotle. His mother had given him a sense of destiny and a goal, to rule the known world. From the age of 3, he could see in his mind's eye the role he would play when he was 30. From Aristotle, he learned the power of controlling his emotions, seeing things dispassionately, thinking ahead to the consequences of his actions. Trace the zigzags of Alexander's maneuvers, and you will see their grand strategic consistency. His quick actions against first Thebes, then Persia, worked psychically on his soldiers and on his critics. Nothing quiets an army faster than battle. Alexander's sudden crusade against the hated Persians was the perfect way to unite the Greeks. Once he was in Persia, though, speed was the wrong tactic. Had Alexander advanced, he would have found himself controlling too much land too quickly. Running it would have exhausted his resources, and in the ensuing power vacuum, enemies would have sprung up everywhere. Better to proceed slowly, to build on what was there, to win hearts and minds. Instead of wasting money on building a navy, better simply to make the Persian navy unusable. To pay for the kind of extended campaign that would bring long-term success, first, seize the rich lands of Egypt. None of Alexander's actions were wasted. Those who saw his plans bear fruit, in ways they themselves had been entirely unable to predict, thought him a kind of god. And certainly his control over events deep in the future seemed more godlike than human. To become a grand strategist in life, you must follow the path of Alexander. First, clarify your life, decipher your own personal riddle, by determining what it is you are destined to achieve, the direction in which your skills and talents seem to push you. Visualize yourself fulfilling this destiny in glorious detail. As Aristotle advised, work to master your emotions and train yourself to think ahead. This action will advance me toward my goal. This one will lead me nowhere. Guided by these standards, you will be able to stay on course. Ignore the conventional wisdom about what you should or should not be doing. It may make sense for some, but that does not mean it bears any relation to your own goals and destiny. You need to be patient enough to plot several steps ahead, to wage a campaign instead of fighting battles. The path to your goal may be indirect. Your actions may be strange to other people, but so much the better. The less they understand you, the easier they are to deceive, manipulate, and seduce. Following this path, you will gain the calm, Olympian perspective that will separate you from other mortals, whether dreamers who get nothing done or prosaic, practical people who accomplish only small things. By Napoleon Bonaparte. What I particularly admire in Alexander is not so much his campaigns, but his political sense. He possessed the art of winning the affection of the people. Total warfare. In 1967, the leaders of the American war effort in Vietnam thought they were finally making progress. They had launched a series of operations to search out and destroy the Viet Cong, North Vietnamese soldiers who had infiltrated South Vietnam and had come to control much of its countryside. These guerrilla fighters were elusive, but the Americans had inflicted heavy losses on them in the few battles they had managed to force on them that year, The new South Vietnamese government, supported by the Americans, seemed relatively stable, which could help to win it approval among the Vietnamese people. To the north, bombing raids had knocked out many of North Vietnam's airfields and heavily damaged its air force. Although massive anti-war demonstrations had broken out in the United States, polls showed that most Americans supported the war and believed that the end was in sight. Since the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army had proved rather ineffective in head-to-head battle against the might of American firepower and technology, the strategy was to somehow lure them into a major engagement. That would be the turning point of the war. And by the end of 1967, intelligence indicated that the North Vietnamese were about to fall into just such a trap. Their commander, General Vo Nguyen Giap, was planning a major offensive against the U.S. Marine outpost at Khe San. Apparently, he wanted to repeat his greatest success, the battle at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, in which he had defeated the French army, driving the French out of Vietnam for good. Khe San was a key strategic outpost. It was located a mere 14 miles from the demilitarized zone that separated North from South Vietnam. It was also 6 miles from the border of Laos, site of a stretch of the famous Ho Chi Minh Trail, the North Vietnamese supply route to the Viet Cong in the south. General William C. Westmoreland, the overall U.S. commander, was using Khe San to monitor enemy activity to the north and west. Dien Bien Phu had served a similar role for the French, and Giap had been able to isolate and destroy it. Westmoreland would not allow Giap to repeat that feat. He built well-protected airstrips around Khe San, ensuring full use of his helicopters and control of the air. He called up substantial numbers of troops from the south to the Khe San area just in case he needed them. He also ordered 6,000 additional Marines to reinforce the outpost. But a major attack on Khe San was nothing he wanted to discourage. In frontal battle, the enemy would finally expose itself to severe defeat. In the first few weeks of 1968, all eyes were on Khe San. The White House and the U.S. media were certain that the decisive battle of the war was about to begin. Finally, at dawn on January 21, 1968, the North Vietnamese Army launched a vicious assault. As both sides dug in, the battle turned into a siege. Soon after the engagement began, the Vietnamese were to celebrate their Lunar New Year, the holiday called Tet. It was a period of revelry, and in time of war it was also a traditional moment to declare a truce. This year was no different. Both sides agreed to halt the fighting during Tet. Early on the morning of January 31st, however, the first day of the new year, reports began to trickle in from all over South Vietnam. Virtually every major town and city, as well as the most important American bases, had come under Viet Cong attack. An army general, tracking the assault pattern on a map, said it resembled a pinball machine lighting up with each raid. Parts of Saigon itself had been overrun by enemy soldiers, some of whom had managed to blow their way through the wall of the U.S. Embassy, the very symbol of the American presence in Vietnam. Marines regained control of the embassy in a bloody fight, which was widely seen on American television. The Viet Cong also attacked the city's radio station, the Presidential Palace, and Westmoreland's own compound at the Tan Son Nhut Air Base. The city quickly descended into street fighting and chaos. Outside Saigon, provincial cities too came under siege. Most prominent was the North Vietnamese capture of Hue, the ancient Vietnamese capital, and a city revered by Buddhists. Insurgents managed to take control of virtually the whole city. Meanwhile, the attacks on Khe San continued in waves. It was hard for Westmoreland to tell what the main target was. Were the battles to the south merely a means of drawing forces away from Khe San, or was it the other way around? Within a few weeks, in all parts of South Vietnam, the Americans regained the upper hand, retaking control of Saigon and securing their air bases. The sieges at Hue and Khe San took longer, but massive artillery and air bombardments eventually doomed the insurgents, as well as leveling entire sections of Hue. After what later became known as the Tet Offensive was over, Westmoreland likened it to the Battle of the Bulge, near the end of World War II. There, the Germans had managed to surprise the Allies by staging a bold incursion into eastern France. In the first few days, they had advanced rapidly, creating panic. But once the Allies recovered, they had managed to push the Germans back, and eventually it became apparent that the battle was the German military's death knell, their last shot. So it was, Westmoreland argued, with the North Vietnamese army at Khe Sanh and the Viet Cong throughout the south. They had suffered terrible casualties, far more than the Americans had. In fact, the entire Viet Cong infrastructure had been wiped out. They would never recover. At long last, the enemy had revealed itself and had been badly mauled. The Americans thought Tet had been a tactical disaster for the North. But another viewpoint began to trickle in from home. The drama at the U.S. Embassy, the siege of Hue, and the attacks on air bases had kept millions of Americans glued to their television sets. Until then, the Viet Cong had operated mostly in the countryside, barely visible to the American public. Now, for the first time, they were apparent in major cities, wreaking havoc and destruction. Americans had been told the war was winding down and winnable. These images said otherwise. Suddenly, the war's purpose seemed less clear. How could South Vietnam remain stable in the face of this ubiquitous enemy? How could the Americans ever claim a clear victory? There was really no end in sight. American opinion polls tracked a sharp turn against the war. Anti-war demonstrations broke out all over the country. President Lyndon Johnson's military advisors, who had been telling him that South Vietnam was coming under control, now confessed that they were no longer so optimistic. In the New Hampshire Democratic primary that March, Johnson was stunned by his defeat by Senator Eugene McCarthy, who had galvanized the growing anti-war sentiment. Shortly thereafter, Johnson announced that he would not run for re-election in the upcoming presidential race and that he would slowly disengage American forces from Vietnam. The Tet Offensive was indeed the turning point in the Vietnam War, but not in the direction that Westmoreland and his staff had foreseen. Interpretation. For the American strategists, the success of the war depended mostly on the military. By using their army and superior weaponry to kill as many Viet Cong as possible and gain control of the countryside, they would ensure the stability of the South Vietnamese government. Once the South was strong enough, North Vietnam would give up the fight. The North Vietnamese saw the war very differently. By nature and practice, they viewed conflict in much broader terms. They looked at the political situation in the South, where American search and destroy missions were alienating South Vietnamese peasants. The North Vietnamese, meanwhile, did everything they could to win the peasants over and earned for themselves an army of millions of silent sympathizers. How could the South be secure when the Americans had failed to capture the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese farmers? The North Vietnamese also looked to the American political scene, where in 1968 there was to be a presidential election. And they looked at American culture, where support for the war was wide but not deep. The Vietnam War was the first televised war in history. The military was trying to control information about the war, but the images on television spoke for themselves. On and on the North Vietnamese went, continually broadening their outlook and analyzing the war's global context. And out of this study, they crafted their most brilliant strategy, the Tet Offensive. Using their army of peasant sympathizers in the South, they were able to infiltrate every part of the country, smuggling in arms and supplies under the cover of the Tet holiday. The targets they hit were not only military, but televisual. Their attacks in Saigon, base of most of the American media, including the CBS newsman Walter Cronkite, visiting at the time, were spectacular. Hue and Khe Sanh were also places heavily covered by American reporters. They also struck symbolic locations, embassies, palaces, air bases, that would suck in media attention. On television, all this would create the dramatic and deceptive impression that the Viet Cong were everywhere, while American bombing raids and pacification programs had gotten nowhere. In effect, the goal of the Tet Offensive was not a military target, but the American public in front of its televisions. Once Americans lost faith, and in an election year, the war was doomed. The North Vietnamese did not have to win a single pitched battle on the field, and in fact, they never did. But by extending their vision beyond the battlefield to politics and culture, they won the war. We always tend to look at what is most immediate to us, taking the most direct route toward our goals, and trying to win the war by winning as many battles as we can. We think in small, micro-level terms, and react to present events. But this is petty strategy. Nothing in life happens in isolation. Everything is related to everything else, and has a broader context. That context includes people outside your immediate circle whom your actions affect, the public at large, the whole world. It includes politics, for every choice in modern life has political ramifications. It includes culture, the media, the way the public sees you. Your task as a grand strategist is to extend your vision in all directions, not only looking further into the future, but also seeing more of the world around you, more than your enemy does. Your strategies will become insidious and impossible to thwart. You will be able to harness the relationships between events, one battle setting up the next, a cultural coup setting up a political coup. You will bring the war to arenas your enemies have ignored, catching them by surprise. Only grand strategy can yield grand results. By Carl von Clausewitz. War is the continuation of politics by other means. Keys to warfare. Thousands of years ago, we humans elevated ourselves above the animal world and never looked back. Figuratively speaking, the key to this evolutionary advance was our powers of vision. Language and the ability to reason that it gave us let us see more of the world around us. To protect itself from a predator, an animal depended on its senses and instincts. It could not see around the corner or to the other end of the forest. We humans, on the other hand, could map the entire forest, study the habits of dangerous animals, and even nature itself, gaining deeper, wider knowledge of our environment. We could see dangers coming before they were here. This expanded vision was abstract. Where an animal is locked in the present, we could see into the past and glimpse as far as our reason would take us into the future. Our sight expanded further and further into time and space, and we came to dominate the world. Somewhere along the line, however, we stopped evolving as rational creatures. Despite our progress, there is always a part of us that remains animal. And that animal part can respond only to what is most immediate in our environment. It is incapable of thinking beyond the moment. The dilemma affects us still. The two sides of our character, rational and animal, are constantly at war, making almost all of our actions awkward. We reason and plan to achieve a goal, but in the heat of action we become emotional and lose perspective. We use cleverness and strategy to grab for what we want, but we do not stop to think about whether what we want is necessary or what the consequences of getting it will be. The extended vision that rationality brings us is often eclipsed by the reactive, emotional animal within, the stronger side of our nature. More than we are today, the ancient Greeks were close to the passage of the human race from animal to rational. To them, our dual nature made us tragic, and the source of tragedy was limited vision. In classical Greek tragedies such as Oedipus Rex, the protagonist may think he knows the truth and knows enough about the world to act in it, but his vision is limited by his emotions and desires. He has only a partial perspective on life and on his own actions and identity, so he acts imprudently and causes suffering. When Oedipus finally understands his own role in all his misfortunes, he tears out his eyes, symbols of his tragic limitation. He can see out into the world, but not inward into himself. The Greeks, however, also recognized the potential for a higher human possibility. Far above the sphere of mortals were the gods on Mount Olympus, who had perfect vision of the world and of both the past and the future, and the human race shared something with them as well as with animals. We were not only part animal, but part divine. Furthermore, those able to see further than others, to control their animal nature and think before they acted, were humans of the most deeply human kind, the ones best able to use the reasoning powers that separate us from animals. As opposed to human stupidity, limited vision, the Greeks imagined an ideal human prudence. Its symbol was Odysseus, who always thought before he acted. Having visited Hades, the land of the dead, he was in touch with ancestral history and the past, and he was always curious, eager for knowledge, and able to view human actions, his own and other people's, with a dispassionate eye, considering their long-term consequences. In other words, like the gods, if to a lesser extent, he had the skill of looking into the future. The consummate realist, the man of vision, Odysseus was a character in the epic poetry of Homer, but there were also historical versions of the ideal. The political figure and military leader Themistocles, for example, and Alexander the Great, raised to heights of combined intellect and action by Aristotle. The prudent man might seem cold, his rationality sucking pleasure out of life. Not so. Like the pleasure-loving gods on Mount Olympus, he has the perspective, the calm detachment, the ability to laugh, that come with true vision, which gives everything he does a quality of lightness. These traits comprising what Nietzsche calls the Apollonian ideal. Only people who can't see past their noses make things heavy. Alexander, the great strategist and man of action, was also famous for revelry and festivity. Odysseus loved adventure. No one was better at the experience of pleasure. He was simply more reasonable, more balanced, less vulnerable to his own emotions and moods, and he left less tragedy and turmoil in his wake. This calm, detached, rational, far-seeing creature, called prudent by the Greeks, is what we shall call the grand strategist. We are all of us to some extent strategists. We naturally want control over our lives, and we plot for power, consciously or unconsciously, angling to get what we want. We use strategies, in other words. But they tend to be linear and reactive, and are often fractured and struck off course by emotional responses. Clever strategists can go far, but all but a few make mistakes. If they are successful, they get carried away and overreach. If they face setbacks, and setbacks are inevitable over a lifetime, they are easily overwhelmed. What sets grand strategists apart is the ability to look more deeply into both themselves and others, to understand and learn from the past, and to have a clear sense of the future, to the extent that it can be predicted. Simply, they see more, and their extended vision lets them carry out plans over sometimes long periods of time, so long that those around them may not even realize that they have a plan in mind. They strike at the roots of a problem, not at its symptoms, and hit their mark cleanly. In moving toward becoming a grand strategist, you follow in the path of Odysseus and rise toward the condition of the gods. It is not so much that your strategies are more clever or manipulative as that they exist on a higher plane. You have made a qualitative leap. In a world where people are increasingly incapable of thinking consequentially, more animal than ever, the practice of grand strategy will instantly elevate you above others. To become a grand strategist does not involve years of study or a total transformation of your personality. It simply means more effective use of what you have, your mind, your rationality, your vision. Having evolved as a solution to the problems of warfare, grand strategy is a military concept. And an examination of its historical development will reveal the key to making it work for you in daily life. In the early history of warfare, a ruler or general who understood strategy and maneuver could exercise power. He could win battles, carve out an empire, or, at the very least, defend his own city or state. But problems came with strategy on this level. More than any other human activity, war plays havoc with emotion, stirs the animal within. In plotting war, A king would depend on things like his knowledge of the terrain and his understanding of both the enemy's forces and his own. His success would depend on his ability to see these things clearly. But this vision was likely to be clouded. He had emotions to respond to, desires to realize. He could not think his goals through. Wanting to win, he would underestimate the enemy's strength or overestimate his own. When Xerxes of Persia invaded Greece in 480 BC, he thought he had a perfectly rational plan. There was much he had not taken into account, and disaster followed. Other rulers actually won their battles, only to grow drunk on victory and not know when to stop, stirring up implacable hatred, distrust, and the desire for revenge all around them, culminating in war on several fronts and total defeat, as in the destruction of the warlike Assyrian Empire, its capital of Nineveh eternally buried in the sand. In cases like that, victory in battle brought only danger, exposing the conqueror to ruinous cycles of attack and counterattack. In ancient times, strategists and historians from Sun Tzu to Thucydides became conscious of this recurring self-destructive pattern in warfare and began to work out more rational ways to fight. The first step was to think beyond the immediate battle. Supposing you won victory, where would it leave you? Better off or worse? To answer that question, the logical step was to think ahead, to the third and fourth battles on, which connected like links in a chain. The result was the concept of the campaign, in which the strategist sets a realistic goal and plots several steps ahead to get there. Individual battles matter only in the way they set up the next ones down the line. An army can even deliberately lose a battle as part of a long-term plan. The victory that matters is that of the overall campaign, and everything is subordinated to that goal. This kind of strategy represented a qualitative advance. Think of chess, where the grandmaster, instead of focusing only on the move at hand and making it solely in reaction to what the other player has just done, must visualize the entire chessboard deep into the future, crafting an overall strategy, using the moves of the pawns now to set up those of the more powerful pieces later on. Thinking in terms of the campaign gave strategy a new depth. The strategist used more and more of the map. War on this level required that the strategist think deeply in all directions before launching the campaign. He had to know the world. The enemy was just one part of the picture. The strategist also had to anticipate the reactions of allies and neighboring states. Any missteps with them, and the entire plan could unravel. He had to imagine the peace after the war. He had to know what his army was capable of over time and ask no more of it than that. He had to be realistic. His mind had to expand to meet the complexities of the task, and all this before a single blow was exchanged. Yet strategic thinking on this level yielded limitless benefits. A victory on the battlefield would not seduce the leader into an unconsidered move that might ultimately set the campaign back, nor would a defeat unnerve him. When something unexpected happened, and the unexpected is to be expected in war, the solution he improvised to meet it would have to suit goals far on the horizon. His subordination of his emotions to strategic thought would give him more control during the course of the campaign. He would keep his perspective in the heat of battle. He would not get caught up in the reactive and self-destructive pattern that had destroyed so many armies and states. This principle of campaigning was only relatively recently christened grand strategy, but it has existed in various forms since ancient times. It is clearly visible in Alexander's conquest of Persia, in the Roman and Byzantine empires' control of vast territories with small armies, in the disciplined campaigns of the Mongols, in Queen Elizabeth I's defeat of the Spanish Armada, in the Duke of Marlborough's brilliantly conceived campaigns against the Habsburgs. In modern times, North Vietnam's defeat, first of the French, then of the United States, in the latter case without winning a single major battle, must be considered a consummate use of the art. Military history shows that the key to grand strategy, the thing that separates it from simple garden-variety strategy, is its particular quality of forethought. Grand strategists think and plan further into the future before taking action. Nor is their planning simply a matter of accumulating knowledge and information. It involves looking at the world with a dispassionate eye, thinking in terms of the campaign, planning indirect, subtle steps along the way whose purpose may only gradually become visible to others. Not only does this kind of planning fool and disorient the enemy, for the strategist, it has the psychological effects of calm, a sense of perspective, flexibility to change in the moment while keeping the ultimate goal in mind. Emotions are easier to control. Vision is far-seeing and clear. Grand strategy is the apex of rationality. Grand strategy has four main principles, distilled below from case histories of the most successful practitioners of the art. The more you can incorporate these principles into your plans, the better the results. Focus on your greater goal, your destiny. The first step toward becoming a grand strategist, the step that will make everything else fall into place, is to begin with a clear, detailed, purposeful goal in mind, one rooted in reality. We often imagine that we generally operate by some kind of plan, that we have goals we are trying to reach, but we're usually fooling ourselves. What we have are not goals, but wishes. Our emotions infect us with hazy desire. We want fame, success, security, something large and abstract. This haziness unbalances our plans from the beginning and sets them on a chaotic course. What have distinguished all history's grand strategists, and can distinguish you too, are specific, detailed, focused goals. Contemplate them day in and day out, and imagine how it will feel to reach them and what reaching them will look like. By a psychological law peculiar to humans, clearly visualizing them this way will turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy. Having clear objectives was crucial to Napoleon. He visualized his goals in intense detail. At the beginning of a campaign, he could see its last battle clearly in his mind. Examining a map with his aides, he would point to the exact spot where it would end. A ridiculous prediction, it might seem, since not only is war in any period subject to chance and to whatever the enemy comes up with to surprise you, but the maps of Napoleon's era were notoriously unreliable. Yet time and again, his predictions would prove uncannily correct. He would also visualize the campaign's aftermath. The signing of the treaty, its conditions, how the defeated Russian Tsar or Austrian Emperor would look, and exactly how the achievement of this particular goal would position Napoleon for his next campaign. As a young man, Lyndon B. Johnson, despite his limited education, was determined to become president one day. Dream turned into obsession. He could picture himself as president, strutting the world's stage. As he advanced in his career, he never did anything without one eye on this ultimate objective. In 1957, Johnson, by that time a Texas senator, supported a civil rights bill. That damaged him in Texas, but elevated him nationally. Apparently a senator from the South had stuck his neck out, risking his job. Johnson's vote caught the attention of John F. Kennedy, who in the campaign of 1960 nominated him for vice president, the job that was ultimately Johnson's stepping stone to the presidency. Clear, long-term objectives give direction to all of your actions, large and small. Important decisions become easier to make. If some glittering prospect threatens to seduce you from your goal, you will know to resist it. You can tell when to sacrifice a pawn, even lose a battle, if it serves your eventual purpose. Your eyes are focused on winning the campaign, and nothing else. Your goals must be rooted in reality. If they are simply beyond your means, essentially impossible for you to realize, you will grow discouraged, and discouragement can quickly escalate into a defeatist attitude. On the other hand, if your goals lack a certain dimension and grandeur, it can be hard to stay motivated. Do not be afraid to be bold. In the large sense, you are working out for yourself what Alexander experienced as his destiny, and what Friedrich Nietzsche called your life's task, the thing toward which your natural leanings and aptitudes, talents and desires, seem to point to. Assigning yourself a life task will inspire and guide you. The goal's nature is critical. Some objectives, if realized, will hurt you in the long run. The objectives of grand strategy in the true sense are to build a solid foundation for future expansion, to make you more secure, to increase your power. When Israel seized the Sinai Desert during the Six-Day War in 1967, what seemed to make sense was creating a kind of buffer zone between itself and Egypt. In fact, this just meant more territory to patrol and control, and it created a cause to motivate enduring hostility in the Egyptian populace. The Sinai was also vulnerable to surprise attack, which is what ended up happening in the Yom Kippur War of 1973. Since holding on to the desert, though seductive, ultimately disserved the needs of security, in the terms of grand strategy, it was probably a mistake. It is sometimes hard to know what the long-term effects of achieving a goal will be, but the more seriously and realistically you examine the possibilities downwind, the less likely you are to miscalculate. Widen your perspective. Grand strategy is a function of vision, of seeing further in time and space than the enemy does. The process of foresight is unnatural. We can only ever live in the present, which is the ground for our consciousness, and our subjective experiences and desires narrow the scope of our vision. They are like a prison we inhabit. Your task as a grand strategist is to force yourself to widen your view, to take in more of the world around you, to see things for what they are and for how they may play out in the future, not for how you wish them to be. Every event has a reason, a causal chain of relationships that made it happen. You have to dig deep into that reality instead of seeing only the surfaces of things. The closer you get to objectivity, the better your strategies and the easier the path to your goals. You can take a step in this direction by always trying to look at the world through the eyes of other people, including most definitely your enemy, before engaging in war. Your own cultural preconceptions are a major hindrance to seeing the world objectively. Looking through other people's eyes is not a question of political correctness or of some soft, hazy sensitivity. It makes your strategies more effective. During the Vietnam War, the North Vietnamese intensely studied the American cultural scene. They looked for shifts in public opinion and strained to understand the U.S. political system and the social effects of television. American strategists, on the other hand, revealed an absolutely minimal understanding of the alien cultures of Vietnam. Whether the South Vietnamese culture they were supporting or the North Vietnamese culture they were trying to fight. Blinded by their obsession with stopping the spread of communism, they failed to note the far deeper influences of culture and religion on the North Vietnamese way of fighting. Theirs was a grand strategic blunder of the highest order. Grand strategists keep sensitive antennae attuned to the politics of any situation. Politics is the art of promoting and protecting your own interests. You might think it was largely a question of parties and factions, but every individual is, among other things, a political creature seeking to secure his or her own position. Your behavior in the world always has political consequences in that the people around you will analyze it in terms of whether it helps or harms them. To win the battle at the cost of alienating potential allies or creating intractable enemies is never wise. Taking politics into account, you must figure out your grand strategy with a mind to gaining support from other people, to creating and strengthening a base. In the Roman Civil War in 49 BC, Julius Caesar faced off against Pompey, who was then the more experienced military man. Caesar gained the edge by planning his maneuvers with an eye to their effect on public opinion in Rome. Lacking support in the Senate, he built support among the general public. Caesar was a brilliant political animal, and what made him so was his grasp of the public psyche. He understood their self-interest and shaped his strategies accordingly. Being political means understanding people, seeing through their eyes. Sever the roots. In a society dominated by appearances, the real source of a problem is sometimes hard to grasp. To work out a grand strategy against an enemy, you have to know what motivates him, or is the source of his power. Too many wars and battles drag on because neither side knows how to strike at the other's roots. As a grand strategist, you must expand your vision not only far and wide, but under. Think hard. Dig deep. Do not take appearances for reality. Uncover the roots of the trouble, and you can strategize to sever them, ending the war or problem with finality. When the Carthaginian general Hannibal invaded Italy in 218 BC, various Roman generals strained to defeat him, but none was effective. The Roman general, later called Scipio Africanus, looked at the situation differently. The problem wasn't Hannibal himself, or his base in Spain, or his ability to restock his supplies by sea from Carthage. The problem was Carthage itself.